Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, August 11th, 2022. Attorney General Merrick Garland says he personally approved the decision to seek a search warrant used by the FBI to search the home of former President Donald Trump. And Garland says he has requested that that search warrant be unsealed and made public. Garland also condemning what he called recent unfounded attacks on the professionalism of the FBI and Justice Department agents and prosecutors in connection with that search and the related investigation. Many of those attacks coming from former President Trump and Republicans in Congress. An armed suspect tries to get into an FBI office in Cincinnati, exchanging gunfire with law enforcement. We'll hear from a spokesperson with the Ohio Highway Patrol. Republican Congressman Liz Cheney, the last of the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, releasing a final campaign video ahead of next week's primary election. Also during this program of Washington Today, the New York City Health Commissioner on the monkeypox virus outbreak and a case of polio found in New York. U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona critical of colleges who he says are investing in the wrong things. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Rwanda. This from USA Today. Attorney General Merrick Garland said Thursday the Justice Department had filed a motion to unseal the search warrant and property receipt from a search FBI agents conducted Monday at former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Palm Beach, Florida. On Monday, agents searched Trump's residence and his safe in what sources familiar with the matter have told USA Today is an investigation related to Trump's removal of classified documents from the White House when he left office. Trump has denounced that investigation. Latest action prompted Trump to make accusations of a witch hunt in all levels of government, including the Bureau itself. That reporting from USA Today. Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C.
Good afternoon. Since I became Attorney General, I have made clear that the Department of Justice will speak through its court filings and its work. Just now, the Justice Department has filed a motion in the Southern District of Florida to unseal a search warrant and property receipt relating to a court-approved search that the FBI conducted earlier this week. That search was of premises located in Florida belonging to the former president. The department did not make any public statements on the day of the search. The former president publicly confirmed the search that evening, as is his right. Copies of both the warrant and the FBI property receipt were provided on the day of the search to the former president's counsel, who was on site during the search. The search warrant was authorized by a federal court upon the required finding of probable cause. The property receipt is a document that federal law requires law enforcement agents to leave with the property owner. The department filed the motion to make public the warrant and receipt in light of the former president's public confirmation of the search, the surrounding circumstances, and the substantial public interest in this matter. Faithful adherence to the rule of law is the bedrock principle of the Justice Department and of our democracy. Upholding the rule of law means applying the law evenly, without fear or favor. Under my watch, that is precisely what the Justice Department is doing. All Americans are entitled to the even-handed application of the law, to due process of the law, and to the presumption of innocence. Much of our work is by necessity conducted out of the public eye. We do that to protect the constitutional rights of all Americans and to protect the integrity of our investigations. Federal law, longstanding department rules, and our ethical obligations prevent me from providing further details as to the basis of the search at this time. There are, however, certain points I want you to know. First, I personally approved the decision to seek a search warrant in this matter. Second, the department does not take such a decision lightly. Where possible, it is standard practice to seek less intrusive means as an alternative to a search and to narrowly scope any search that is undertaken. Third, let me address recent unfounded attacks on the professionalism of the FBI and Justice Department agents and prosecutors. I will not stand by silently when their integrity is unfairly attacked. The men and women of the FBI and the Justice Department are dedicated, patriotic public servants. Every day, they protect the American people from violent crime, terrorism, and other threats to their safety while safeguarding our civil rights. They do so at great personal sacrifice and risk to themselves. I am honored to work alongside them. This is all I can say right now. More information will be made available in the appropriate way and at the appropriate time. Thank you. Thank you all for your questions, but as I said, this is all I can say at this time.
Attorney General Merrick Garland making that statement at the Justice Department. New York Times has a story that former President Donald J. Trump received a subpoena this spring in search of documents that federal investigators believed he had failed to turn over earlier in the year when he returned boxes of material he had improperly taken with him upon moving out of the White House, three people familiar with the matter said. Article goes on, the subpoena suggests the Justice Department tried methods short of a search warrant to account for the material before taking the politically explosive step of sending FBI agents unannounced to Mar-a-Lago, Mr. Trump's home, and members-only club. Also, the Twitter account at Judiciary GOP, which is the House Judiciary Committee Republican members, tweeting this as Merrick Garland was speaking. Think Merrick Garland will apply the same standards to Hunter Biden? Nope. And then they have another tweet quoting Merrick Garland, equal justice under law. And they add, unless you're Hillary Clinton or Hunter Biden. Both Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal reporting this week that an inside informant tipped off the FBI about what classified documents remained at Mar-a-Lago beyond those 15 boxes the National Archives took in February and where on the property they may have been stored. Former Trump White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney telling CNN today that such an informant would have to be very close to the former president.
Do you think that person in Trump's orbit would have had to be to know these details about where these documents were?
That's a good question. Really close. I didn't even know there was a safe at Mar-a-Lago, and I was the chief of staff for 15 months. So this would be someone who was handling things on day-to-day, who knew where documents were. So that would be somebody very close inside the president. My guess is there's probably six or eight people who had that kind of information. I don't know the people on the inside circle these days, so I can't give any names of folks who come to mind. But your instinct, I think, is a good one, is that if you know where the safe is and you know the documents are in 10 boxes in the basement, you are pretty close to the president.
Mick Mulvaney was an acting White House chief of staff during the Trump administration, interviewed on CNN this morning. Mick Mulvaney also saying that he never saw the intentional destruction of documents for the purpose of keeping anything from the National Archives or the public, and that everyone, including himself, sometimes did rip up documents, but they knew the rules and they often taped them back together to preserve them. Story at the Associated Press, an armed man decked out in body armor tried to breach a security screening area at an FBI field office in Ohio on Thursday, then fled and was injured in an exchange of gunfire in a standoff with law enforcement, authorities said. AP article adds this, the confrontation that began at the FBI Cincinnati field office came as officials warned of an increase in threats against federal agents in the days following a search of former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. Nathan Dennis is a spokesperson for the Ohio Highway Patrol. He gave an update to reporters early this afternoon.
At 9:15 this morning, a male subject attempted to gain entry into the FBI field office in Cincinnati. He was armed. He was unsuccessful and he fled that area. The FBI then contacted us, let us know what had occurred and what type of vehicle he had left the scene in. He was traveling in a white Ford Crown Victoria. He headed northbound on Interstate 71. Near the rest area, the northbound rest area on Interstate 71 in Warren County, one of our troopers did spot the vehicle, attempted to initiate a traffic stop. This was at 9:37 this morning. Attempted to initiate a traffic stop with that vehicle, and a pursuit ensued out of that. Throughout the pursuit, it continued northbound on 71. The suspect vehicle did fire shots during that pursuit. The vehicle then exited on State Route 73 and went east on State Route 73. They traveled east to Smith Road. They went north on Smith Road, almost over top of Interstate 71, where the vehicle came to a stop. Once the vehicle came to a stop, gunfire was exchanged between officers on scene and the suspect. At this time, no officers have been injured as a result of this. The scene is still active, and there is still an active standoff situation occurring at this time.
Nathan Dennis, a spokesman with the Ohio Highway Patrol, early afternoon. Late word is that that standoff has ended, but the status of the suspect remaining unclear as the status or his motives for doing what he did. This is Washington Today. U.S. House and Senate not in session today, but the House Oversight and Reform Committee holding a virtual roundtable about election misinformation. And one of the witnesses, Tina Barton, a member of the Committee for Safe and Secure Elections, former city clerk in Rochester Hills, Michigan, describing threats against election workers.
I recently concluded a 32-year career in public service where I served at the local, county, and federal levels. The last 16-plus years of my career were focused on election administration. On election night, November 2020, my team made an error when saving an absentee file that contained results for 7 of our 32 precincts. The error was found and quickly corrected. That following Friday, a press conference was held by a national Republican political figure at the Oakland County Republican Party headquarters. The county party that had nominated me as their candidate for Oakland County Clerk Register of Deeds. President Trump and I both lost in our county, but that press conference changed my life forever. No one contacted me to ask what had happened or to seek the truth. Instead, this statement was made. Just last night in Oakland County, we found 2,000 ballots that had been given to Democrats that were Republican ballots due to clerical error. And this took place in Rochester Hills. You could hear the gasp of everyone in the room, and I was stunned. I responded with the following statement shared by video. My name is Tina Barton. As a clerk, my job is to run the elections fairly and securely. All ballots are and have been accounted for. There were no missing ballots. The accusation that 2,000 were found is categorically false. As a Republican, I am disturbed that this is intentionally being mischaracterized to undermine the election process. This was an isolated mistake that was quickly rectified once realized. Every voter should have complete confidence in our voting system. Every vote that was cast was counted accurately, and there is a paper ballot backup. And I stood by our reported result. 4 days after that press conference, I received my first death threat. It was laced with obscenities, threats to my life and my family members' lives, and used sexually charged language. Pardon me. While the details of my story are unique, over 1,000 incidents of hostile and harassing contact have been reported to the DOJ. Mis- and dis- and malinformation is dangerous, and it's fueling these threats. We need your help. We need your help with protection. We need your help with increased awareness of the threats and intimidation. We need grant funding that is specifically designated to assist officials. If elections are truly critical infrastructure, we must protect them and those that administer them. Thank you.
Tina Barton, former city clerk, Rochester Hills, Michigan, and now member of the Committee for Safe and Secure Elections, testifying before the U.S. House Oversight and Reform Committee. A member of that committee, Republican Congressman Pete Sessions of Texas, during his statement, criticizing the Biden administration for not investigating what he says were clear indications that voting in the 2020 elections not completely fair.
The issue that is before us today is a very interesting one, because you see where there are questions asked, especially of elections officials, there are no answers. There is silence. Oh, they defend themselves. Yes, ma'am, they do. But even the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who has been given many, many, many of these, what I would call abnormalities, inconsistencies, and irregularities, has yet to even acknowledge the receipt of those. They do not even begin to look at the information that was presented to vastly to the American people, 2,000 mules. And when I have provided to the Federal Bureau of Investigation 3 years ago and 1 year ago, detailed information that we assumed that we were asking questions about and expected to hear something back, we did not call it vote fraud. We called it abnormalities, inconsistencies, and irregularities. And yet the Federal Bureau of Investigation even refuses to acknowledge receipt of this information.
Republican Congressman Pete Sessions at today's House Oversight and Reform Committee roundtable about election integrity and misinformation in elections. It was held virtually. The last U.S. House Republican who voted to impeach former President Trump faces voters next week, Liz Cheney from Wyoming. She's also vice chair of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The primary is August 16th. Today, she released a final campaign video. Runs about 2 minutes.
As Election Day nears, I want to talk to citizens across our great state and all across our country. America cannot remain free if we abandon the truth. The lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen is insidious. It preys on those who love their country. It is a door Donald Trump opened to manipulate Americans to abandon their principles, to sacrifice their freedom, to justify violence, to ignore the rulings of our courts and the rule of law. This is Donald Trump's legacy, but it cannot be the future of our nation. History has shown us over and over again how these types of poisonous lies destroy free nations. Like many candidates across this country, my opponents in Wyoming have said that the 2020 election was rigged and stolen. No one who understands our nation's laws, no one with an honest, honorable, genuine commitment to our Constitution would say that. It is a cancer that threatens our great republic. If we do not condemn these lies, if we do not hold those responsible to account, we will be excusing this conduct, and it will become a feature of all elections. America will never be the same. Nothing in our public life is more important than the preservation of the miracle given to us by God and our founding fathers. Nothing. Here's my pledge to you. I will work every day to ensure that our exceptional nation long endures. My children and your children must grow up in an America where we have honorable and peaceful transitions of power, not violent confrontations, intimidation, and thuggery, where we are governed by laws and not by men, where we are led by people who love this country more than themselves. No matter how long we must fight, this is a battle we will win. Millions of Americans across our nation, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, stand united in the cause of freedom. We are stronger, more dedicated, and more determined than those trying to destroy our republic. This is our great task, and we will prevail. I hope you will join me in this fight. I'm Liz Cheney, and I approve this message.
That campaign video posted today. A new University of Wyoming poll shows that Liz Cheney's main Republican primary opponent, Harriet Hageman, leads her 57% to 28%, a poll of voters. And 41% of the voters surveyed say they are voting against Liz Cheney rather than strongly supporting one of her opponents. Harriet Hageman out with a final TV ad itself. It starts with a very quick montage of Liz Cheney news clips.
Republican Liz Cheney.
There's been an awful lot of noise this election. Candidates attacking each other, making things up, desperate for attention. Liz Cheney, she's made her time in Congress and this election all about her. Well, it's not about her. It's about you. Wyoming deserves a voice in Congress to fight for our values, our way of life. I'm Harriet Hageman. I approve this message because I want to fight for you.
And the primary for Wyoming's sole U.S. House seat, the Republican primary, is next Tuesday. Epic Times writes that the five candidates running in that primary have raised over $20 million, making it the costliest congressional race in Wyoming's history. Wyoming has the smallest population of any state in the United States, about 575,000, although it is the 10th largest state by area. Conventional wisdom at the moment is that Republicans will win enough seats to get a majority, at least one House of Congress after the midterm elections in November, but still 3 months to go. A discussion today about what a House Republican majority agenda might look like with Douglas Holtz Eakin, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. He began by talking about the economy. Again, under conventional wisdom, it's the economy that will be one of the most important issues to voters.
There was a lot of excitement about the Consumer Price Index data that was released yesterday because it showed the top line CPI inflation flat during the month of July. I'm an economist. I live to provide a dark cloud for every silver lining. And so I'm just here to say that that report, I think, if looked at carefully, showed no real signs of progress. We knew gasoline prices were down and down sharply, and that drove the top line. If you go past that, there's nothing but more of the same. Core inflation, non-food, non-energy inflation was year over year at 5.9%, as it was the month before. And that food, energy, and shelter are about half of a typical family's budget. And so I spent a lot of time looking at the shelter component. It's a third of the CPI by itself. And shelter inflation was up yet again. It has been rising continuously since January of 2021. It's now at 5.7% year over year. And you can't get to a 2% target with shelter inflation at 6%, everything else has to be zero. And so the Fed is going to have to do the kinds of things that bring down shelter inflation and other kinds of services, because that's where the inflation is right now. And those aren't like gasoline. They're not volatile. They don't go up and down easily. You have to lean hard and continuously. And so we're going to see more of the same for months now. And one of those months is going to be November, when the election takes place. And that will come on the heels of the Fed having raised rates pretty aggressively to try to get inflation back under control. And I think that's the future.
So how much is history working against President Biden and the Democrats? Has there ever been a point in U.S. history where a sitting U.S. president during a recession and such high inflation numbers hasn't lost control of either chamber?
So I'm going to dodge the question for a second and simply go back to the recession issue. I don't think we are in a recession. I just want to be clear about that. A recession is a sustained broad decline in economic activity. We don't have the breadth of decline that I think qualifies as a recession. It's hard to imagine a recession with the labor market adding, 500,000 jobs in a month. That doesn't feel like a recession. And so we have some signs of problems. There's no question about it. The Fed has been quite honest about the fact that raising rates as it must to deal with inflation could in fact produce a recession. They'd prefer not. They'd like to get a soft landing, but history's against them. The odds of pulling that off are low. So we may enter a recession late this year, early next year. I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation, but the doom and gloom right now in the moment, I think, is overstated. But to your point, midterms are typically bad for sitting presidents. The opposition typically takes over. You have big changes in control. Most people, when you look at the polling, name the economy inflation as the number one issue. So the environment is not good for this president. And the second issue is crime. And there's very little that a president can do about that on the ground. And so that's a bad issue set in a time when typically the president's going to take a hit. So it's not particularly promising for President Biden.
Douglas Holtz Eakin was Congressional Budget Office Director 2003 through 5, and he's now president of the American Action Forum, a program today hosted by the Bipartisan Policy Center. On Wall Street, the Dow up 27, NASDAQ down 74, S&P down 2. Applications for unemployment insurance benefits rose last week in the U.S. by 14,000 to a total of 262,000. It's the highest level since last November. Associated Press article, though, adding that the U.S. job market continues to show signs of strength. AAA says the average price of a gallon of gas in the U.S. now under $4 for the first time in months. And the Labor Department reporting today the Producer Price Index, which measures inflation before it reaches consumers at the wholesale level, fell 0.5% in July, first monthly drop since April 2020. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention webpage that tracks the monkeypox virus outbreak in the U.S. says there are now over 10,000 confirmed cases in the United States, mostly concentrated in a couple of states, including New York, California, Florida, and Texas. But every state has at least one case except one state, Wyoming. The New York City Health Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Vasan, was interviewed today by Washington Post national health reporter Dan Diamond.
The first confirmed case of monkeypox in the U.S. was detected less than 3 months ago. Now there are more than 10,000 confirmed cases. About one in five are in New York, making your city the epicenter. So, Commissioner, where are we in the course of this outbreak? Is this the beginning, the middle? Are we getting anywhere near the end?
It's a really interesting question because from the beginning, we haven't really had enough testing at hand. And so for an epidemiologist, it's an extraordinarily hard position to be in to try to wrap your arms around an epidemic without really understanding what the denominator is and what's out there in terms of transmission. Now we've seen testing ramp up over the last month in particular. So we are doing a significant amount of testing and we are seeing cases increase. But over the last week, I think we've seen the velocity of that case increase or the number of, you know, the day on day increase kind of start to ebb a little bit. It's too early to tell whether we're even anywhere near a peak. But I would say that we're somewhere in the middle, right? I think we still have a chance to slow this down, which is why we've been so aggressive on vaccination and primary prevention, especially targeted at the most at-risk communities. But, you know, I think we're still weeks, if not months away from really seeing a sustained decline in case transmission. And so we still have a lot of work to do.
The New York City Health Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Vasan, at today's Washington Post live program. And it was focused mostly on monkeypox, but he was also asked about another virus that's now shown up in New York. As CNN reports, a polio case identified in New York last month is, quote, just the very, very tip of the iceberg and an indication there, quote, must be several hundred cases in the community circulating, a senior official with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention told CNN on Wednesday. The case was found in Rockland County, which has a stunningly low polio vaccination rate. That reporting from CNN, here is the health commissioner.
A man in New York several weeks ago tested positive for polio. The state health department has said that potentially hundreds of people have been infected. What are you doing in New York City to detect polio? And do you have any data yet on its potential spread?
Well, I think as the state health commissioner, Dr. Mary Bassett, noted in her press release, and as we've published on our websites with polio vaccination rates across New York City by zip code and otherwise, there are certain areas of our city and certain areas of our state that have low rates of polio vaccination coverage of children. That is three doses that most of us get in order to go to school. So there are some communities that have chosen, and there are some neighborhoods and places that have chosen not to emphasize vaccination in the same way. And so now is our chance to redouble that effort to really target messaging, to target outreach, to target support, and to obviously distribute vaccine to provide trusted providers in the most affected communities. You know, we have some communities in New York City with polio coverage rates as low as 56%. And so that's really troubling. We need at least 80% to achieve any sort of herd immunity for polio. And so, we must redouble our efforts. We are tracking this through mainly wastewater surveillance. And as Dr. Bassett said, and others have said, you know, a case of paralytic polio usually is a sign that there's community transmission going on, and that's been confirmed by our wastewater sampling. So we're really redoubling our efforts. I know the CDC has sent resources to Rockland County to help, and we're redoubling our efforts in the city to get ahead of this. This is also a very personal issue for me. My aunt, my dad's sister, died in India of polio when she was in medical school. My uncle, who's still alive, has paralysis, has paralytic polio, and is disabled as a result of it. And so it is discouraging, of course, that we're talking about diseases that were close to eradicated in recent memory. And I think this is a call to action for all of us around immunization. The COVID-19 pandemic and all of the misinformation and disinformation that's been circulating around the vaccines has really impacted certain communities more than others and is leading to an overall vaccine hesitancy that we haven't seen in decades. And it's having impact across a whole host of diseases we're seeing. Now is our time to really redouble our efforts around childhood immunizations and getting kids in particular back to school in the fall and getting up to date on all of their vaccines.
The New York City Health Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Vasan, with Washington Post health reporter Dan Diamond, a virtual discussion covered by C-SPAN. Polio was last detected in the United States in 2013. An update about COVID-19, this from Associated Press, the nation's top public health agency relaxed its COVID-19 guidelines Thursday, dropping the recommendation that Americans quarantine themselves if they come into close contact with an infected person. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also said people no longer need to stay at least 6 feet away from others. The changes, which come more than 2.5 years after the start of the pandemic, are driven by a recognition that an estimated 95% of Americans 16 and older have acquired some level of immunity, either from being vaccinated or infected, agency officials said. That from AP. With the new school year about to begin, the U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona speaking today at a summit with higher education leaders in Washington, D.C. at the Education Department headquarters. It was titled Raise the Bar in College Excellence and Equity, with BAR, an acronym for Bold Action Results. Secretary Cardona saying that colleges and universities are focusing on the wrong things, trying to reach what they perceive as excellence.
It's a cruel irony that the institutions that serve the most students with the most to gain from college degree have the fewest resources to invest in student success. You already know this, and it's heartbreaking. 60% of black undergrads and nearly half of Latino undergrads never make it to graduation day. Imagine the potential loss in this country due to this fact. We've normalized this in this country. Every year, millions of students wind up in what I call post-secondary purgatory. They earn some credits, but no degree. Then they have student debt they cannot afford and a limited path to higher paying jobs. It's a generational effect. Meanwhile, many institutions spend enormous time and money chasing rankings they feel carry prestige, but in truth, do little more than Xerox privilege, as one HBCU president said. There's a whole science behind climbing up the ranking. It goes like this. You compete for the most affluent students by luring them with generous aid, because the most well-prepared students have the best SAT scores and graduate on time. You seek favor from your peers from other elite schools with expensive dinners and lavish events because their opinions carry clout in surveys. And you invest in the most amazing campus experiences that money can buy, because the more graduates who become donors, the more points you score. Too often, our best resource schools are chasing rankings that mean very little on measures that truly count. College completion, economic mobility, narrowing gaps in access to opportunity for all Americans. That system of ranking is a joke. In case I haven't been clear yet, allow me to restate it. We need a culture change in higher education now. We must stop conflating selectivity with excellence. We must stop correlating prestige with privilege. We must embrace a new vision of college excellence.
The Education Secretary Miguel Cardona at the Education Department building in Washington at today's Higher Education Summit. He also announced $5 million to support what is now known as a College Completion Fund for post-secondary student success. It'll go to existing students who are close to graduation and students who withdrew from school temporarily during the COVID-19 pandemic and would come back at historically black colleges and universities, tribal colleges and universities, and Hispanic-serving institutions. The news site The East Africa reports that Rwanda has rejected calls to release Paul Rusesabagina, who was found guilty of crimes related to terrorism, despite intense lobbying by the U.S., which has termed his arrest as wrongful detention. A permanent resident of the U.S., portrayed in the film Hotel Rwanda, saving lives of hundreds of ethnic Tutsis during the 1994 genocide, was sentenced to 25 years for terrorism by a Rwandan court last year in what his supporters called a sham trial. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, visiting Rwanda today at a joint news conference with the Rwandan foreign minister, saying that he brought up this case during a meeting with the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame.
In our discussions, I also raised serious concerns about human rights. As I told President Kagame, we believe people in every country should be able to express their views without fear of intimidation, imprisonment, violence, or any other forms of repression. That's true whether they're political opponents, human rights defenders, journalists like the ones in this audience, or simply citizens. These are values cherished by the American people and people around the world. That's why I raised them, as have members of the U.S. Congress. I raised the case of Paul Rusesabagina, who is a lawful permanent resident of the United States, and underscored our concerns about the lack of fair trial guarantees provided to him. Later today, I'll have an opportunity to visit the Kigali Genocide Memorial. It'll provide a chance to reflect on the unimaginable horrors of the genocide, which reverberate to this day, to reaffirm the importance of standing up rather than standing by in the face of atrocities, and to ask ourselves what history teaches us about the need to prevent hatred and fear from taking hold again and squandering the progress the people of Rwanda have made since that time. We have the deepest admiration for the people of Rwanda, their courage, their resilience, all that they have built, and we hope conversations we've had today will help our partnership grow even stronger.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Kigali, Rwanda, the capital city. It's his last stop on his three-nation tour of Africa. A joint news conference with Rwandan Foreign Minister Vincent Burundi, who was also asked about the Paul Rusesabagina case.
On the question about Rusesabagina, as far as the government of Rwanda is concerned, Paul Rusesabagina is a Rwandan citizen, and he was arrested, he was tried, and convicted along with 20 other accomplices for serious crimes they committed against Rwandan citizens, and which he committed while residing in the United States. And this was done lawfully under both Rwandan and international laws. Therefore, Rwanda will continue to abide by our laws and the decisions made by our judiciary. And we would request our partners to respect Rwanda's sovereignty, Rwanda's laws, and its institutions. That's what I can state about the question of Rusesabagina.
The Rwandan Foreign Minister, Vincent Burundi, joint news conference with the visiting U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. Secretary Blinken also saying the U.S. very concerned about what he called credible reports that Rwanda had provided support to M23 rebels in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. This is Washington Today. From WISH TV in Indiana, family and close colleagues of Congresswoman Jackie Walorski, Republican from Indiana, on Thursday said they would remember her commitment, her tenacity, and her energy. Hundreds packed the auditorium for Walorski's funeral at Granger Community Church. Ranging from close family and neighbors to dozens of members of Congress, Walorski was one of four people killed in a crash 8 days ago. The other three, two of her staffers and the driver of the other car. One of the tributes today came from Congresswoman Ann Wagner, Republican from Missouri, who was first elected to the House in the same year as Jackie Walorski, 2012. Ann Wagner said they became close friends.
If there weren't floor votes, committee work, or an event, most evenings you would find Jackie and me having dinner at the Scarlet Oak, enjoying a salad and splitting a margarita pizza. Jackie liked to eat early, go to bed early, and begin texting and phoning early. Very, very early, even on Saturdays. And I was on Central Time, not Eastern Time. These were traits we did not have in common. We did, however, have many things in common. And I'm not just talking about our passion for basking in the sun and soaking up the rays. Jackie was a no-nonsense, get-it-done, move-it-or-lose-it woman of strength and intense integrity. Her beloved husband, Dean, said that Jackie commanded every room she walked into. She was personable, connected, and articulated her beliefs with passion and conviction. Whether that belief was standing tall for the sanctity of life and our precious unborn, or for providing for the needs of the everyday families and businesses that she served so faithfully in the 2nd District of Indiana, day in and day out. Dean, you were the love of her life. It was always Dean, Dean, Dean. She couldn't wait to get home to you, and you were always there to greet her. Your support and boundless love enabled Jackie to fulfill her passion of service for others.
Congresswoman Ann Wagner, Republican from Missouri, paying tribute to the late Congresswoman Jackie Walorski, Republican from Indiana, at today's funeral. Many House Republicans were also there, including the Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who said, "Tell you the truth, Jackie never had a job. She always had a purpose and a mission." Jackie Walorski was 58 years old. Thank you for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get more of the stories being talked about in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.